Part 3. Contentment. The Bluebird of Happiness. Chapter 7. Contentment and Serotonin. Question. Over the course of history, what prescription medication has evidenced the greatest societal impact? Well, you could argue that cholesterol-lowering drugs, statins, are the most prescribed for the treatment and prevention of heart disease and have made the most money. You could make the case that anti-malarials have saved millions of lives, especially in third world countries. Protease inhibitors turned AIDS from a ruthless killer into a public nuisance. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories such as ibuprofen and naproxen have alleviated pain in a majority of people. How about narcotics and anesthetics? Having surgery 200 years ago without them was extremely unpleasant, although the recent scourge of opiate addiction might be starting to negate that positive impact. Maybe Viagra. That certainly increased the happiness of a portion of the population. Pick any of the above. You would be wrong. Answer: fluoxetine, Prozac. Psychiatric hospitals once were the saddest places on earth. Think One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1962. I still have nightmares about Nurse Ratched. Chock full of patients with schizophrenia, patients who thought people were out to kill them or plotted to kill others due to dopamine dysfunction, and patients with clinical depression, people who would have welcomed being killed due to serotonin dysfunction. But at its worst, schizophrenia affected only about 1% of the population. Consider the fact that major depressive disorder, MDD, affects 16 to 18% of the U.S. population at some time in their lives, and that any given moment, 6 to 8% of the people you know are affected. This is a very big deal and takes a huge toll on the individual, on his or her family, and on society. Psychiatric drugs are truly a miracle of Western civilization. For many years, scientists and doctors have been trying to understand what made some people suffer from severe depression, while others seemed preternaturally happy and stars of their own Disney movie. In 1952, a serendipitous finding launched the field of modern psychopharmacology. As is the case with the first generation of many mood-stabilizing treatments, we actually used it to treat a different malady altogether. Patients with tuberculosis, treated with a drug known as isoniazid, or INH, still the drug of choice when you're exposed to someone with TB, out of the blue, experienced a lifting of their depression. INH worked on the neurotransmitter serotonin, as well as other areas of the brain, and with more trials and focus, scientists were able to pinpoint that it was the effect of serotonin that caused depressed TB patients to reemerge into the world of the living. Thus, scientists learned that serotonin was responsible, in part, for the feelings of happiness and contentment, and, when out of whack, could cause severe irritability and depression. Plumbing the depths. There are two kinds of depression. People with retarded depression can't get out of bed and would kill themselves if they had the energy to do so. They often need to be hospitalized to be kept away from themselves, but they pale in numbers compared to the people with agitated depression, who are anxious, irritable, sleepless, and just plain miserable. Both types are associated with individuals eating and sleeping far too much or far too little, both of which are activities that involve serotonin. When Prozac, the first in the class of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, hit the market in 1986, prescriptions for antidepressants shot up a record 400% over the next 15 years. The genius of Prozac was that it didn't matter which form of depression you had. Whether you were climbing the walls or plumbing the depths of your own psyche, Prozac could bring you to ground. Due to both Reagan's funding cutbacks and Prozac's successes, over the next two decades, inpatient psychiatric facilities closed faster than Blockbuster Video. I watched this phenomenon occur during my medical fellowship. There weren't even enough depressed people in the hospitals to keep them open. And nobody cared about the schizophrenics, so they got dumped onto the street where they remain today. Prozac, or one of its many cousins, sertraline or Zoloft, citalopram or Celexa, and paroxetine or Paxil, to name but a few, are now prescribed to alleviate or mitigate a great many mental disorders. Today, SSRIs are the number three most prescribed class of drugs. More people under age 65 take antidepressants than any other medication, and as many prescriptions were filled for antidepressants as for cholesterol-lowering drugs. Currently, 11% of all adolescents are taking an antidepressant, not just for depression, but for anxiety, anger management, premenstrual syndrome, and obsessive-compulsive disorder as well. The frequency of diagnosis of depression is still on the rise. However, we don't know if this is due to an increased awareness among the medical community, like ascertainment bias, if insurance coverage has provided the impetus for overdiagnosing. After all, pills are lucrative to drug companies and cheaper than psychotherapy. If more adolescents are depressed because of bullying and school pressures, or if people and doctors just want to provide a quick fix. But is it a fix? Not for everyone. And how does it work? Before we start talking about serotonin and contentment, let's go back to dopamine and motivation. Dopamine is the reward initiator, and firing of dopamine neurons changes behavior. Remember, the dopamine neurons in the VTA have two primary targets. One, the nucleus accumbens, or NA, where the dopamine signal is translated into desire and reward. Hey, I'm stressed, give me a Krispy Kreme. And two, the prefrontal cortex, or the PFC, where the dopamine signal is tempered by cognitive control, your inner personal Jiminy Cricket. Happy feet. But serotonin differs from dopamine in many ways, which makes it difficult to understand and to study. First, serotonin is utilized by different parts of the body. The overwhelming majority, 90%, is produced and used in the gut, where serotonin is involved in neural and hormonal responses to feeding and how full you are. Another 9% can be found in the platelets of our bloodstream, where serotonin helps our blood to clot. That leaves a total of 1% of all your body's serotonin in the brain itself. This is why we just can't measure the amount of serotonin in blood or urine to diagnose depression, because the amount is more a reflection of what's going on in the gut or the bloodstream than in the brain. As an example, carcinoid, which is a tumor of the intestine that overproduces serotonin, causes severe diarrhea, flushing, and abdominal pain and cramping, but it doesn't have very much in the way of central nervous system actions, and it definitely doesn't make its victims happy. But your urine and blood will definitely show high levels of serotonin and its breakdown products. There's no biomarker for depression, no blood test that your doctor can administer. To diagnose clinical depression, doctors use a questionnaire, known as the Beck Depression Inventory, or BDI, which scores different subjective symptoms of depression. This validated instrument is equivalent to your brain's serotonin meter. Serotonin neurons fan out to many different parts of the brain. When these signals are interpreted, either separately or together, we describe the neural experience as some form of happiness. Presumably, this is one reason why happiness has so many different definitions, manifestations, and inputs, because different interactions between different parts of the brain influence different phenomena: joy, elation, love, etc. We know that serotonin is partially involved in contentment and well-being, but we don't yet have all the details. What's more, dopamine has only 5 different receptors in the brain, although most of the reward effects are mediated by the D1 and the D2 receptors. In contrast, serotonin has at least 14 different brain receptors to which it binds. And while there are certain receptors that exert the majority of the serotonin effect, it makes it very difficult to piece together what is happening in any specific area. Thus, unlike dopamine, unraveling the role of serotonin in human happiness is a much tougher affair. Isolating serotonin neurons and figuring out what they do in humans would require some very questionable neurosurgery from some very questionable neurosurgeons. Gene Wilder as Dr. Frankenstein? For this reason, we have had to use primarily animal models for this work. But this leads to a big question. Is happiness a human attribute exclusively? How can you tell if an animal's happy? Are there any behaviors that animals demonstrate that are reflections of happiness rather than the result of overlay by reward or pleasure? I've talked to several animal behaviorists at the Society for Behavioral Neuroendocrinology about this. One form of happiness, the nurturing behavior that occurs between parents and offspring, is mediated by oxytocin, the bonding hormone, rather than serotonin. But what about general happiness in animals? Ken Lokavara, an eminent paleontologist, he discovered the biggest dinosaur remains in Patagonia, suggests that Antarctic penguins repeatedly slide down ice chutes into frozen water with no secondary gain or reward. There's no food involved, just an expenditure of energy. This behavior can't have any survival advantage, just a general sense of, whee! So perhaps this is their amusement park and they're demonstrating joy? Or is it pleasure? And that's penguins. Are rats or mice happy? How are we able to tell when a rat or a mouse is depressed? For one, we know what they like, sex and sugar, and when they don't perform to get it, I guess they're depressed, just like us. And we know that antidepressants will alter their behavior. And from rodent work, we end up extrapolating to humans. There still exists a large stigma toward the diagnosis and treatment of depression, as if it were a personal moral failing. For many who suffer from depression or who have loved ones who do, the idea of it being their fault makes no sense. Who would choose this? Indeed, people with genetic differences anywhere in their brain's serotonin system are at greater risk for suicide. Hardly a choice for these people. The sublime science of serotonin. Similar to that recounted for dopamine, serotonin physiology also has the same three points of regulation. Many things can go wrong, which may cause symptoms of depression. Optimizing each step in the process is necessary to reach our own individual zen. 1. Synthesis. Serotonin is an ongoing requirement throughout life. Its primary building block is the amino acid tryptophan, which you must eat. You can't make it. It also happens to be one of the least available items in the human diet. Tryptophan is found in greatest quantity, but yet still pretty rare, in eggs, fish, and poultry. Many vegetable protein sources are notoriously low in tryptophan. Fewer building blocks means less product. Not enough tryptophan in the diet means less serotonin can be made. So, you have a limited amount of tryptophan in your system to make serotonin, which is actually a hot commodity in your brain. Most of the tryptophan consumed is going to be used to produce serotonin in your gut. Only 1% is available for your brain. There isn't just one serotonin factory in the body. In fact, once serotonin's been made in the gut or elsewhere, it can't cross the blood-brain barrier. Your brain's on its own, and it's got to make serotonin itself. And the brain serotonin factory is localized to a long, thin area deep in the most primitive part of the brain called the raphe nuclei. Tryptophan is only one type of amino acid, one of the building blocks of protein, that needs to make it into the brain. These building blocks hop on amino acid transporters to cross over from blood into brain. The problem is the transporters, like taxicabs at 11 o'clock on a snowy New Year's Eve, are sometimes difficult to come by. Tryptophan is in competition with at least two other amino acids, phenylalanine and tyrosine, which are the building blocks for dopamine. So guess what, folks? The more building blocks for dopamine, that is reward-seeking behavior, in your blood, the fewer taxis that are available for tryptophan to head to Party Central in the brain and whip up some contentment for the evening. This competitive mechanism of tryptophan transport into the brain is but one way by which reward trumps contentment. More are coming in the next chapters. 2. Action. Similar to dopamine, serotonin is released from its nerve terminals and must traverse the synapse to meet up with its receptor. Serotonin nerve terminals are all over the brain in order to bind to different receptors to exert different effects. Thus, the actions of serotonin are much harder to quantify because A, there's no clear anatomic location, B, there are too many receptors to keep track of, and C, there are many different kinds of responses among people and even within the same person. Unfortunately, we aren't entirely sure which receptors work which way. For instance, triptans, such as sumatriptan, are a class of drugs that bind to two specific serotonin receptors, and they are the best anti-migraine medications that we physicians have at our disposal. But taking these medications does nothing for your state of mind, although if you've ever had a migraine, then not having one is a state of bliss. One receptor in particular, the serotonin 1A receptor, seems to be uniquely involved in decreasing anxiety and mitigating depression. It's the binding of serotonin to this receptor that is equated to well-being and contentment. We know this because we've been able to genetically remove that specific receptor from mice. When they don't have it, they are extremely anxious, and no amount of antidepressant is going to fix it because the receptor's gone. The serotonin 1A receptor has been a hotbed of concern for psychiatric disease for decades. In one Japanese study, genetic serotonin 1A receptor differences are associated with bipolar disorder, which we used to call manic depressive illness. Drugs that bind to the serotonin 1A receptor, known as agonists or chemical mimics, are a mainstay of antidepressant therapy, and new drugs are coming online at a very rapid pace. For instance, buspirone, or Buspar, is a commonly used serotonin 1A agonist in the treatment of severe anxiety. 3. Clearance. After the packets of serotonin transmitters are released from the neuron, they need to traverse the synapse to get to the receptor. After they've bound to the receptor, they hang out in the synapse, waiting to be recycled or deactivated. The same process takes place here as it does with dopamine, using the same enzyme, monoamine oxidase, or MAO, which will degrade serotonin into its waste product, 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid, or 5-HIAA. The MAO acts as a Pac-Man here as well, essentially gobbling up and destroying serotonin molecules. This is why MAO inhibitors, such as phenelazine or Nardil, work as antidepressants, by keeping the levels of serotonin elevated, fostering more chance to bind to a receptor. Alternatively, the serotonin transporter is a protein that recycles serotonin from the postsynaptic neuron back to the presynaptic neuron, so it can be repackaged and used again the next time the neuron fires. These serotonin recyclers or transporters perform the same function as the dopamine transporter mentioned in Chapter 3, acting as hungry, hungry hippos. They will suck the serotonin back into the neuron to be recycled and released again. This is the site of action of all of the newer selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, like fluoxetine or Prozac, sertraline or Zoloft, citalopram or Celexa, and escitalopram or Lexapro, to increase the amount of serotonin within the synapse in order to elevate mood. So, what these SSRIs do is basically put a muzzle on the hungry, hungry hippos. They're still functional, just less so. However, you don't want to knock them out of the game completely. Having too much serotonin in the synapse can also be a problem, as we'll discuss later. Always look on the bright side of life. How well your serotonin recycler or transporter works has a lot to do with how happy you are. Temperament goes a long way in explaining happiness, and differences in the serotonin transporter go a long way in explaining differences in temperament. For instance, those born with a specific allele or genetic variation in their serotonin transporter, known as the 5-HTT-LPR, are quite anxious as children and are more likely to suffer into adulthood as a result of an unstable home life, that is, have a greater propensity for anxiety, depression, and drug abuse. As an interesting aside, despite consistently experiencing more adverse circumstances throughout American society, African American adults routinely exhibit a lower incidence of clinical depression than do Caucasians and Latinos. This is not explainable by sampling differences, sex differences, or levels of education. African Americans exhibit less anxiety than Caucasians do. There may be several reasons for this dichotomy. One thought is that these questionnaires may be culturally biased, which may in fact be true. Another possibility is that the African American population of the U.S. exhibits a higher affiliation with a religious denomination than any other racial group, which may provide them with a social basis for achieving happiness despite socioeconomic adversity. But there may be a biochemical reason as well. African Americans are known to have a genetic difference in the gene that encodes that 5-HTT-LPR, the serotonin transporter, the hungry, hungry hippo, which reduces the ability to clear serotonin from the synapse. Thus, African Americans may have their own built-in SSRI, so they get less depressed in the face of adverse circumstances. But, just as with dopamine, too much of a good thing can become a bad thing. Serotonin can have serious side effects, including irritability and suicidal thoughts and actions. Excess serotonin effects can lead to negative levels of mood and outward behaviors such as impulsive aggression because of binding to receptors other than the 1A receptor. Serotonin syndrome, which results from too much serotonin activity because of SSRI overdose or interactions with other drugs, is characterized by changes in mental state and muscle tone and autonomic nervous system problems. Going overboard on serotonin can take someone who's morose and just give them enough brain activity and mental energy to make them suicidal, which is why people on antidepressants should not dose themselves. Just as with dopamine, the goal is not to increase your serotonin status indiscriminately, but rather to find your sweet spot. Most of us, as numerous surveys indicate, concede that the most important goal of life is happiness. But the quest for happiness begins and ends with optimization of your serotonin neurotransmission. Clearly, no easy feat. Chances are, you've seen a commercial for an antidepressant. It generally starts with a woman looking forlorn in cold gray weather. Then, magically, the sun is shining, she's smiling, her kids are well-behaved, and they all live happily ever after. Alas, there is no one magic pill. Medications work differently on different people, and they may lose or gain effectiveness over the lifespan. The dosage of Prozac taken by an 18-year-old may not work the same way when he or she is 40. After giving birth, women's hormones go into a tailspin, and they may experience postpartum depression, necessitating the usage of antidepressants. After a year or so, their serotonin may go back to normal on its own, or it might not. Antidepressant medications can work wonders, but only 25% of those who take them experience a full remission. The remaining 75% may experience some relief, but not complete reversal of symptoms. More aid is needed. Even for those of us who do not suffer from depression, few of us know how to attain contentment. Short of SSRIs, what hope do we have of achieving any meaningful happiness in this life? Are we really Prozac Nation? Not quite. More to come.